Blog Talk Radio.
Knowledge Beyond the Book Club with your host, Charles Williams, and my co-host, Jolivet. Say hello, Jolivet.
Hello, Jolivet.
All right. That never gets old.
Does that ever get old? Oh, my God.
Yes.
We just entertain ourselves.
That's what you got to do.
But anyway.
Yeah, and we're back with those great writer, historian,
yes.
Scholar, Dr. Jeff Perry, to discuss his two-volume work, Hubert Harrison's Voice of Harlem Radicalism, and this is a wonderful series. We're asking, re-educating us on what was suppressed, and like to welcome Dr. Perry on to the program. Hello, Dr. Perry.
Hello, Charles Olivet. How you both doing?
Oh, we're doing great.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, we thank you for, joining us again, taking the time out of your busy schedule to, share with us the research that you've been doing for the last 30 years.
I'm honored and excited to be on the show with you. I think it's so important, the work you're doing, and I appreciate the chance to talk about Hubert Harrison, with you.
You're more than welcome, and we like to even discuss great Theodore Allen's work as well on another series, perhaps if your schedule permits.
Mm-hmm.
But, that'll be sprinkled in here because we know the works are both connected. Somewhat, and last week we were talking about the New Negro Movement and how it was being transformed and the obstacles that Harrison had to deal with, especially following his departure from the Socialist Party. And his program to try to reach more Negroes in the 20s in order to expand and get us on even in Africa, even in the continent. To see our situation was really being managed by a complex military social control formation that we have called white supremacy, and that was the impetus behind everything we were seeing in religious, politics, education, sex, you name it, all these sectors of social and human activity. And you can, I think you have some thoughts that you had, were able to, some ideas, I think, from what you had been studying.
I think what you're saying is very, very accurate. White supremacy was the system of social control in this country, and it totally dominated every aspect of society. And Harrison knew that. He really understood that, and he tried to address it. And I want to point out how very important Harrison is for your listeners, because he was the key radical influence on A. Philip Randolph and the class radicals of that period, and on Marcus Garvey and the race radicals. So I think it's important to understand that he's a key ideological link in the unity of these two great trends of the black liberation struggle. I mean, and the fact that we've not known more about him for all these years has hurt the struggle, right? I mean, if we would have known more, we could have. There's much to learn from Harrison that could have been used in various struggles since then. So when Harrison, I think when we were talking last week, we talked about his experience in the Socialist Party, and he was tireless. He wrote the first major theoretical positions in the socialist press on the Negro and socialism. He spoke 23 times a week for the party. He spoke before 40,000 people, but he ran into personal and more general instances of white supremacy. Down south, the party only held segregated meetings, and he was a vociferous opponent of that. And he felt he was being subjected to a double standard in the New York area where he was functioning. And before the big 1912 convention, he laid it before the party. He said, what's it going to be, the direction of this party, Southernism, which everyone understood as white supremacy, or socialism? And the party did not even address that in its main convention and its debates, although it did discuss Asian immigration and took horribly racist positions on that, that this is a white man's party and things like that. So over between the period between 1912 and 1914, Harrison moved further to the left of the Socialist Party and eventually out. In that period, he was active with the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which is famous up in this area for the Patterson strike, Patterson, New Jersey, and Lawrence, Massachusetts strike. They were very involved, and these were major industrial struggles in this period, Patterson in 1913. And in the books that I put out, you'll see pictures of Harrison with the leading labor militants of the era, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Big Bill Haywood, and others. The IWW was also very big down south, and they actually had interracial unions in amongst timber workers, right? And that was very, very unique for the South. But it came under very severe attack, the overall organization, in the period between 1912 and World War One. You know, there was a real offensive against the militant left organizations. And when Harrison wound up leaving the Socialist Party in 1914, he did so, and he kind of summarized it, that the white socialists and the white labor movement put the white race first before class. And that's another important insight he had, because, you know, it leads us directly to the question and to Alan's work, what is this white race thing, which we can pick up again in another topic. But what Harrison then does is he's speaking on the street corner, you know, in New York. He's got to make a living. He's got, by this time, he's got four children, he and his wife, right? And he would make a living by selling books on the street corner and talking, and he'd talk on evolution, birth control, the war that was developing in Europe with its implications for the whole world, particularly Africa and the U.S. And people like James Weldon Johnson would see him on the street corner, and Johnson was writing for a black weekly in New York called the New York Age, and of course people know him for the Negro National Anthem and a host of other things, right? But Johnson saw Harrison and said, this is like a university course on the streets. We've got to get him to concentrate fully in the community, right? And with under such prodding, Harrison turns to concentrated work in the black community, really starting around 1916. One other thing that prompted him to move in that direction, and people will find interesting because of the situation we see today, is he started analyzing in some of his writings the role of the, at that time it was called the Negro actor and the Negro playwright, the role in the arts that black people were playing and were in many cases forced to perform. And it's similar today to, you know, people's question about, you know, the images that come across on TV and in the media and everything like that. And he started addressing that, and that really prompted him to say, no, this is, we've really got to concentrate. We've got to start looking at what's going on and really you know, develop a new understanding, a new consciousness of where this has to go. And so in late 1916, he starts developing ideas for the type of race unity that is needed amongst the African-American population. And he very clearly distinguishes when he sets out to do this that what's needed is, unlike the previous uniters, he writes a little passage in one of his pieces, unlike the previous uniters, and he's referring to Booker T. Washington, who was the most powerful black man in America up, you know, for the first decade and a half, from the late 19th century up to the first decade and a half of the 20th century, and had his powerful Tuskegee machine, right, of political appointments, and was, you know, tied to very powerful white people, right? And that's where the money support for his efforts came, largely came from. And Booker and W.E.B. Du Bois, who was associated with the concept of the talented tenth of the Negro race, the educated and cultured and should be made leaders of the race. That's what Du Bois wrote, right? And Harrison said, well, the previous uniters started at the wrong end. They started at the top when they should have started at the bottom, amongst the masses. And he says, light the fire at the bottom, right? And you'll see such heroic effort and such energies coming forth. And interestingly, in 1940, in his third autobiography, Du Bois kind of comes to that, and he says, gee, you know, I think that effort, that notion, you know, was right, and where I was taking it was not necessarily right, you know, but that's much later. But so Harrison starts developing that idea, and of course that's what we see in the Garvey movement later on, which Harrison, you know, has a significant impact on. Mm-hmm. And so Harrison is delivering lectures. He's in New York and New Jersey primarily in this late 1916, early 17 period, and it's calling for race consciousness in response to the race first of the white socialist and white labor movement. He goes, we have to put race first. We have to concentrate. And he starts developing, you know, cooperative ideas, just all types of working together ideas, lays out a platform and a program for essentially putting forth the civil rights legislation, you know, enforcement of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And he's also advocating militant armed self-defense, because in this period lynching is a major issue in the African-American community. And he actually, as early as 1917, is putting out public calls for armed self-defense, and that's before the East St. Louis pogrom that occurs that year. He's putting out calls for armed self-defense when Tulsa erupts, right, and people get torched and burned out of their homes, Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921, and before the summer of 1919, when throughout the country there are attacks as these troops come home, and there are vicious attacks on black communities across the nation. So, and Harrison is also advocating federal anti-lynching legislation. And federal anti-lynching legislation, as I believe I mentioned last time, although most people associate that with the NAACP, they refuse to advocate federal anti-lynching legislation in that first decade between 1910 and 1920. And the basic reason, and all this is documented in the books, in my books, which we'll cite again, you will mention for listeners later, but they didn't want to alienate Southern white support. So with this perspective and with a host of followers, because all the younger generation were really following Harrison's lead, because he was a militant new leadership, right, in New York area. And so he founds the New Negro Movement. New Negro Movement. He founds it in 1917. Now, people, if they've been taught New Negro at all in schools, and for many years it wasn't taught at all, but then when it was being taught, You'd learn about Alain Locke in 1925 in a publication called The New Negro, and a largely middle-class literary movement associated with that Locke publication. But Harrison's New Negro Movement, he had an organization called the Liberty League and a newspaper called The Voice, which is subtitled A Newspaper for the New Negro. That's a subtitle, and this is in 1917 to 1919. And they hold, the Liberty League holds its first meeting in June of 1917, and the featured speaker is Harrison. Adam Clayton Powell Sr., the father of Adam Clayton Powell, is one of the speakers. Chandler Owen, who's the cohort of A. Philip Randolph, is another featured speaker. And at that rally, Harrison even invites a young and relatively unknown Marcus Garvey up to the platform to speak. So this is and that's the founding meeting in June. And then July, he comes out with the first issue of The Voice, the newspaper. And it really sweeps, within a matter of weeks, they're selling, maybe 10,000 copies or distributing 10,000 copies in New York area, which is very significant given the black population at that time and also the literacy levels, right? Because not everyone was reading at that time, and the estimates are that any one paper would have a circulation of an additional 5 or 6 because the papers would get passed around. So it had a right. tremendous impact. And W.A. Domingo, who becomes the first editor of Garvey's Negro World later on, and is a boyhood friend of Garvey's from Jamaica, writes that we all followed Hubert Harrison in this period. Harrison was in the lead, and he was awakening, and it was the young generation, and they were considering themselves new Negroes in opposition to that older, more established Negro leadership, which they felt had not provided the leadership that was needed, right? Just one more thing, and I'll take a breath. The U.S. was at war to make the world safe for democracy. Woodrow Wilson had led. That was what Woodrow Wilson said, right? But right. Harrison, in that first meeting, when they had the call for the Liberty League, their first flyer, they say, let's make the South safe for democracy, because, of course, lynching, segregation, disfranchisement throughout the South. And so it was, consciously in opposition to the imperialist efforts and the false claims of the Woodrow Wilson administration. And so it was a militant organization, and it was militant socially and politically, but it was also extremely literary. And people should understand this. It wasn't just a radical movement, but every newspaper that Harrison edited from that time on would have poetry for the people and book review sections. And he was a brilliant writer, brilliant book reviewer. So that's something of the founding, how he comes to found the New Negro Movement.
Wow.
We good?
That would be great.
Okay. Great. And that movement comes now. One thing that people will find of interest, these are just a few little anecdotes I want to point out, but Marcus Garvey actually joins Harrison's Liberty League. Now, for people familiar with Garvey, he's not known to be one to join anyone else's organization. So that gives some sense of the impact. And in my biography of Harrison, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, that's the first volume, 1883 to 1918, which is available online, Amazon and all these other places, and it's a Columbia University Press book. But you can go to my webpage, which is simply my name, jeffreybperry.net. You can read all about the book, you can read the reader's comments, and you can get all kinds of free information on Harrison. You'll see quotes from many other contemporaries about how Harrison was the major radical influence on this generation. And he's doing this. While he's doing this, he is living at 231 West 134th Street in Harlem. For people not familiar with Harlem, at that time, this was the most densely populated block in the community. He is in and of and amongst the people, right? He is really, grassroots and bringing it up, and he would write wonderful pieces on the common people and how much he used that phrase, in a positive sense, on how much people had to offer. It's a mass appeal he was making, and it was resonating. People were really picking up on it. One other thing, just anecdotally, but people might find of interest, and in the biography I have a picture. I don't know if I have one up on the webpage. But Harrison develops a tricolor flag for his Liberty League, and the original tricolor flag that he develops, the colors are black, brown, and yellow. And he explains that's because that's the colors we are domestically and internationally. And from that tricolor, within a year or two, Garvey switches to the red, black, and green, which, of course, people know today and associate as the black liberation colors. But it's a little history people might not be familiar with.
That's great. I didn't know that either. But you know, it's interesting because Harrison, like you say, he was of the people. He was not a part of that petty bourgeoisie that, you know, that Townsend that has been dominating black society, you know, for the last 110 years at least. You know, and it's like I would say the community has, the greater masses are still not only ignorant of Harrison's work, you know, but the ignorant of the effect, the variant, the differences in direction, like, you know, following, you know, the ideals of the new Negro movement versus old Negro movement. And so the old Negro movement had been, you know, or fashioned into a dichotomy of like the Booker Washington and the W.B. Du Bois movement, you know. And
it was
like the same boss and the new boss, same as the old boss, and we're going to fight over here in this little controlled, argument. And it's just pathetic that over time people. I mean, I'm saying we're still looking back with even some nostalgia. I mean, I'm a critic of these. Even the civil rights movement, because that's the same old guard that ran that. You know, the SCLC, SNIC is all connected to the same old guard. I mean, Du Bois was, you know, they all signify Pi. They're all, you know, in the same other, many other fraternal organizations, you know.
Right.
You know, just to be mentioned. And they all were funded by the same people, you know, Heritage Foundation, Ford, you know. All these people, they're getting the same money, and Harrison obviously wasn't getting any of that money because he was not bought.
Matter of fact, he turned down twice. In 1917, when he founded the Liberty League, he was, according to the accounts, and this is, you know, I talk about this in the book, he was offered $10,000 by a white supporter, and he refused it, saying, no, we want to maintain our independence and our integrity. And then again, and this will come out in 1920, in Volume 2, in 1921, the Communist Party offered him a sum of money to be what was phrased the stalking horse against Garvey, and he says, no, I'm not doing that. You know, and not that he didn't have criticism of Garvey, but he was not going to be anyone's tool. Now, and what we see also in Harrison is he is an autodidact. He's self-educated, right, like we see in Malcolm later and so many others, so many important people and historians in African-American, African history, right? He's self-educated, and he had a great integrity. He would pursue issues because he thought they were important. You know, he wasn't trying to hustle to make, you know, get a degree, make a living, you know, get funding or anything like that. And, of course, he paid the price. He paid the price. That's, you know, one of the reasons he's not better known. Not that I think he should have done any other course, because his legacy is so important, and now I see it. I see it as I go around, how people are gravitating towards it, and they want just more and more. And listeners will probably be pleased to know, besides Volume 1 of the biography, which is out, we have Volume 2 coming. And these are big 600-page volumes, right? There's already a reader out of 138 of Hubert Harrison's writings, a Hubert Harrison reader. And Black Classics Press some years ago did an edition of Hubert Harrison's 1920 book, When Africa Awakes. And I'm coming out with a new edition of that one with more, you know, more supplemental material for Diasporic Africa Press. And the main project is the project to put all 800 of Harrison's writings online for free via Columbia University's webpage, but permanent, searchable, so people in Shreveport, people in Atlanta, people in Chicago, wherever, you know, can access this stuff and read him, because he's a brilliant writer and thinker, and just a major figure in U.S. history, radical history, black history, and I think he's going to just grow and continue to grow in importance in the 21st century. And that's why I think it's so important that, you know, you're discussing him on your show and helping to get out the word, because I think people will really appreciate learning about him.
I'm certain. And the more we know, the more we – go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, just since I mentioned Harrison's When Africa Wakes, I just want to, again, drive home the point of his role in this New Negro. And the New Negro movement, this militant movement that Harrison founds, is in many ways comparable to the Black Power movement of the 1960s, right? And
yeah.
Very militant and, you know, proud and everything like that. Now, in 1919, Harrison edits a magazine called The New Negro, a monthly magazine of a different sort intended as an organ of the international consciousness of the darker races, especially of the Negro race. This is a magazine called The New Negro in 1919, 6 years before Alain Locke. In 1920,
right.
That book that I mentioned that he wrote, When Africa Wakes, it's subtitled The Inside Story of the Stirrings and Strivings of the New Negro in the Western World. He uses Africa in the racial sense, if you will, right? And
right.
So this is all way before Alain Locke. And now, but if you look today, Henry Louis Gates came out with a book within the past year, Life Upon These Shores. It's meant to be the overall survey of African-American history. Not one mention of Hubert Harrison in that book, right? And but, of course, Gates had, you know, in his early writings, he had written on the New Negro as far back as 1988, I think. He wrote, you know, some journal articles and stuff and never mentioned him. And this is not to pick at Gates, but it's this notion that, you know, for a lot of the academics, even today, you know, U.S. history, labor history, black history, you know, people writing on these topics, if they've been writing on them for 20 or 30 or 40 years and haven't mentioned Harrison, it is going to be hard for them to come and say, gee, this Hubert Harrison is really important. And that's why I think it's going to come increasingly from the grassroots and from the younger generation, the import, you know, Harrison's import. And when I say that, I always have in mind what Arthur Schomburg, Harrison's friend and the real driving force behind the great research institution in New York, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, right? A major public library in New York that Schomburg and Harrison were both founding offices of. But when Harrison dies, Schomburg delivers the eulogy at his mass funeral, and there were thousands at Harrison's funeral when he died, so he was very popular when he lived. And Schomburg knew how popular he was, but he said, Hubert Harrison is ahead of his time, right? And that, again, is why one reason I think he will be talking to generations in the 21st century also, you know. So.
Right, right. And that's what we, you know. Thank you for sharing this this information in this revised historical perspective on the basically the struggle for the for the liberation of Negro African peoples in the 20th century, and you know, and looking at all the events and how it shaped to us being where we are right now, which you know, and without that perspective, we are bound to repeat gross errors that could easily be avoided with, learning lessons of our predecessors and giants like Harrison.
If people get a chance to look at the Hubert Harrison read, and one thing I would really encourage, Charles, if people hear this, is to try and get these books into public libraries, because it's there that people then can access Harrison, people who might not, you know, be in a position to be buying these books, you know, online and things like that.
Right.
If we can get them into, or if people can break it down, you know, and get Harrison out in other ways. But if you look at the book, A Hubert Harrison Reader, which has about 138 of his articles, you will see him writing on questions of class, on race, on black leadership, on internationalism, on imperialism, book reviews, theater reviews. People will be blown away by the breadth of you know, his intellect and his interest and his and what he has to say, because what he writes is truly profound, and that's why a lot of the important but not established, if you will, historians, black historians of the 20th century knew how important Harrison was. People like John Henry Clark and John G. Jackson and Joel A. Rogers, you know, some of these people who passed on, and Richard B. Moore, they carried on the tradition and they kept passing it and maintaining it and spreading it to younger generations. And they all, with great respect, you know, talk about Hubert Harrison. And that's some, Dr. Ben, if you go to the webpage, you will see Dr. Ben. One other thing I'll just mention for listeners, because they may have seen something about this in the newspapers the past few days. But on the webpage, you'll see also a woman named Yuri Kochiyama holding the Hubert Harrison book up. Now, Yuri Kochiyama, if people are not familiar with her, just passed away about a week ago at age 93. She was a Japanese-American who had been put in the internment camps during World War II, but was long active in the Asian movement, black movement, Puerto Rican movement, Native American. She was very, very close friends with Malcolm and Betty Shabazz. She's the one who was cradling Malcolm's head in her arms at the Audubon Ballroom, because, you know, when he was there. But and now there's big efforts underway on both coasts to, you know, commemorate her life, you know, both in the Bay Area and New York area. She lives the last couple of years there, although she's from Harlem originally. Not originally, but her main life. But that's just another person in this tradition of carrying and keeping alive Harrison's name.
Well, Robert, thank you for telling us about this, the passing of this amazing woman. And we look forward to, you know, you coming back and sharing some more information at your earliest convenience. And this has been the most enlightening and revealing study of this university course.
Well, again, Charles, just if we can encourage people, the webpage is www.jeffreybperry.net. And if you go across the top or down the right-hand side, there's all little links you can take to, and you can get whole sections on Hubert Harrison biography, and they come in different articles, different lengths, 500 words to 1,000 words to 12,000 words. You have videos, you have audios. It's the kind of stuff that people can share with others.
Right, and I really, you know, we have occupied library movement also. At page. And we, you know, strongly encourage. We'll put this we'll put this program on that page as well, and also petition our listeners and advocates to encourage the university, and city and municipal libraries and high school libraries to, you know, acquire these works for the benefit of, you know, of some people. So it's his history. So, you know, and it's our money. It's public money. We pay the taxes, and we should be able to have the books in it that we want to read.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I may have mentioned previously, Harrison considered free public libraries one of the great institutions in this country, and he was, you know, one of the founding officers of Schomburg Center. But he wrote great essays like read, even out of school, you know, encouraging people to read and think, you know, and be independent. And although we didn't get to talk about it too much, when he first comes to the U.S. from St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, in that first decade in New York, he's in what they call lyceums. He would go to these lyceums. They would get togethers, and they'd have speakers at two of the black churches in New York on 53rd Street at that time, before the IRT subway was completed up to Harlem. One was called St. Benedict the Moor Roman Catholic Church, and another was St. Mark's, which is AME Church, right? And Harrison would he wrote, and Schomburg, the atmosphere was so great. They would discuss and debate openly. Harrison says we wouldn't beat the devil around the stump. You know, we'd bring our ideas forward, and then at the end of the session, people could still go out, you know, and be friends, right? And which is the type of intellectual atmosphere we need today, because we've got serious issues we've got to deal with, but we've got to be able to talk about it and really express our honest opinions with some, you know, thought given to them. And he called it the germ of Negro racial consciousness in Negro New York in that first decade. And what was important also was you had African Americans, you know, native born in the U.S., and Afro-Caribbeans and people coming from Africa getting together. And sometimes there's differences, you know, people coming, you know, and people aren't familiar with each other in some ways. But it was a place where people could come together and really, you know, it was the basis for what came later. And they were black working class intellectual circles. These were all working people coming together and doing this, right? So it was very, very inspiring, I think, you know.
Me too. And I, you know, definitely like to explore that dimension. Matter of fact, the working class element, like you said, lighting the fire at the bottom.
Yeah, well, Harrison said it.
Right.
Yeah, he had it.
You're quoting it.
Yeah, and you see later in the Garvey movement, because Harrison says, another thing Harrison says, you light the fire at the bottom, and he says, listen, we're not going to probably be able to achieve one organization that's going to encompass everybody. It's very difficult, he goes, but we can have unity of purpose, you know, we can have a general direction that we're all clear on, right? And I think that's what you see later in the Garvey movement aspects of it, you know, with the one aim, one, you know, things like that. And I mean, you have to, you know, you can clarify, but I think if you get the masses, you know, involved and keep that class perspective within the movement, right, you know, so it's not dominated by, you know, people who might have more selfish interest at play, as we saw in the 60s, you know, much, much can be accomplished, because that 60s, as I think I spoke last time, was a catalyst for every other movement in the country. The civil rights, black liberation struggle shook this country. It impacted every other movement, a major force for positive, you know, and so.
Right. Right, lighting that fire at the bottom instead of at the top. Though it shook, I'm saying the civil rights movement shook the country, the laity was not really educated on the mechanics of white domination,
mm-hmm.
this whole white social control thing. And that's
mm-hmm.
what, you know, we really want to, even though we talk about, you know, black African culture for the purpose of preserving your identity or integrity, you know, for you know, black, large and black audience, you know, remain,
mm-hmm.
you know, help remain and have that integrity intact, not compromising that in order to function.
Right.
You know, your life, as, you know, in order to survive in the world, when you have to give up your who you are in order to, you know, meet your basic human necessities, you know. And that's what that's what has happened since that time. We had just figured out, oh, we have to give up ourselves in order to live. So it becomes, you know, holding your integrity is death, and giving up your integrity of your, you know, who you are, your history, is life. And that's exactly the opposite, you know.
Yeah, I think, Harrison, I think, agreed with you totally on what you're saying. I mean, and he was very clear on, you know, maintaining that integrity, and he understood the African roots and ties, and a very positive attitude towards, you know, aspects of African history and things like that, and knowledge. He had great knowledge. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was glad you illustrated how, you know, the work Harrison has written already about that. And
yeah.
I was, you know, just putting it how that talented 10th idea was all about giving up that black, you know, proving to the white, you know, the white power structure that, you know, the demonstrating their civilized, you know, nature or acumen by, you know, by becoming decreasingly African, you know, and
mm-hmm.
imitators of white, you know. And that's, you know, that's how you see them. They got the suits on. They trying to, you know, talk as much like they, you know, and skin lightening cream and all these things that they promote. You know, I've read John's publication my whole life, and so, you know, I'm familiar, you know, with that whole mimicry of, you know, everything. Like you say, look at the black university; it's a copy of the you know, the white university. Everything, instead of saying, well, what could we learn and incorporate our history and culture into making students to become of what, you know, our inherent needs are, you know, apart from serving,
right?
Like that white social formation, and that's all of education created by that Thompson 10th group in the 1904, constructed a whole curriculum from, you know, the General Education Fund of Rockefeller, you know, from grade school to university, to make the most sophisticated servants in the world. And that's not the new Negro movement. That's the
right.
old Negro movement. And right. you know, that's, you know, what, you know, we clarified, I believe.
Yeah, and Harrison writes some wonderful things on education too, and you'll find in that reader. I mean, he's given thought, as you have, you know, to these issues. And what's interesting also, in 1920, when he's working with Garvey, and Harrison is the principal editor of the Negro World, one of the plans that they had talked about was for Harrison to head a Negro university, you know, of the movement and stuff. Because he when J.A. Rogers writes his piece, his wonderful biographical portrait of Harrison in World's Great Men of Color, he describes him as intellectual giant and freelance educator. So Harrison was really into this education, you know, as you're talking about. One other thing I wanted to share, it may be a little bit along, I think it is along the lines of what you're talking about, if it's about a paragraph where Harrison talks about the Pan-African movement. Can I share that with folks right now?
Yeah.
Here's what he goes. He goes, the Pan-African movement, as I have come to understand it, is the conscious expression by Africans of their desire to rule their own ancestral lands free from the domination of foreigners, however exalted and benevolent. But that isn't all. As a cultural movement, it connotes a desire to preserve the soul of the African by laying respect for his own institutions as the basis for any access and knowledge that may come to him through the more highly developed technologic process of the European, which are at the same time spiritually disintegrating, not only to a people to whom they are new, but in their very real essence as determined by the persistent effects as revealed in the history of European civilization. And civilization, he often puts in quote, right? For you must know that we Africans do not see in quote progress, you know, that means, you know, the progress that is being offered, that be all and end all, which you Europeans do. We think that stability is important, and this restless, wearisome striving after the wind always leaves nine-tenths of your people short of such specific satisfaction as food, clothing, and shelter. So he's talking about European civilization, capitalism, just coming, you know, and tearing things apart. And yeah, it's important to have some understanding of what can and should be preserved, maintaining one's integrity. I find that very interesting in Harrison. He read a lot about Africa and corresponded with people. He never got to travel there. But one thing he did do, and I heard this from both his son and daughter when they were alive, is all five of his children, he gifted to them a book entitled Negro Culture in West Africa by a fellow named George W. Ellis. It was written in the early part of the 20th century. But, you know, just passing that on to the next generation, kind of a little, you know, African history and knowledge of it. And in his diary, if people get to read the reader, you'll see a wonderful, wonderful diary entry from 1907 titled Untamed, Untamable African, in which he describes himself as an untamed, untamable African and dedicates his life to service of the mother race in Africa, right? And when he does that, what's interesting, it's a wonderful piece, but to this very day, if you go online, or last time I looked anyway, Assata Shakur had that very prominently on her webpage, you know, Harrison's diary entry on, you know, a message of an untamed, untamable African. So he's got many, many interesting aspects of Harrison.
Okay, well, I'm glad you said that with us. That was a great follow-up. And we thank you, Dr. Perry. Appreciate you for coming on, spending all this valuable time with us over these past few weeks. And you're welcome to come back, you know, anytime. And we definitely want to, you know, do an exposition on the invention of white rays and the significance of the study that you have still incorporated with it to help people understand the social control formation.
I would love to, and thank you so very, very much. I really appreciate spending this time with you and sharing, you know, with people. Thanks again.
Okay, you're welcome. You all are great listeners. Astronaut Network, stay tuned, stay strong, stay real.